Well, I think we're going to begin now, and thank you all for coming out here. I'm not going to introduce our speaker because I asked him to do that as part of his presentation because he has an interesting background, and I thought he could do that better than I could. But we are very pleased to have Rabbi Niles Goldstein here with us tonight. He was here once before, I guess about 4 years ago, and we were able to bring him back. And we're in conversation with him about possibly joining us for next semester and helping with a couple courses. So tonight I asked him if he would start out by giving us a fairly comprehensive introduction and then also talk about one of the courses that he's proposing to teach next semester if he's here, and then open it up for questions that people might have of him. And so I'll leave it there, Niles, and let you take the stand and give us your story.
Thank you. Thanks, Ed. Take the stand. It sounds so litigious. It's you Mennonites, I thought you were pacifists and been confrontational right off the bat. Ed, I'm glad you're all here. Thank you for coming. It's going to be very informal. I'm just going to talk a little bit, as Ed said, about my background as a rabbi and as a writer. And then talk a little bit about this proposed course and whatever questions it triggers, you know, feel free to answer or ask. So I was here 4 years ago with a colleague of mine who is the founder of an organization called the Foundation for Religious Diplomacy. And my background, though I have been a congregational rabbi for about 12 or 14 of my 20 years in the rabbinate, has been pretty eclectic, and a lot of my work has been in the interreligious dialogue arena. So it's great to be back. EMU is a fascinating place. Ed and Trina and others have been running me ragged since I woke up. Excuse me. So I'm not, you know, I'm between meeting with students and faculty. It's been, you know, it's a fascinating place. So I've had a great time. So in terms of my background, just really briefly, and it's connected to the elective that I'm thinking of teaching, and that I was talking to a class earlier today on playwriting and screenwriting about. I want to talk about writing and the role that writing and writers have played in my rabbinate, to be alliterative about all of this. I have always been a writer. I have wanted to be a writer long before I even considered becoming a rabbi. I always had a pretty strong sense of Jewish identity. I grew up in a Jewish home in the Chicago area. But from a spiritual point of view, religious point of view, observance point of view, it wasn't something that was a huge part of my life. That would change over time. But writing was always huge. Short stories, journals. In high school, I wound up becoming the editor of my high school newspaper. Went to college. I was going to dual major in English and philosophy. I wound up going to Hebrew University in Jerusalem for my junior year abroad. You know, that was a very interesting experience. When I came back, I didn't have enough credits to double major, so I kept the philosophy, kept the real practical major, and then wound up minoring in English, and continued my journalism writing, and wrote a novella at that time. And then, like a lot of seniors, maybe not at EMU, because I just heard a startling statistic that 78% of your graduates go into some kind of service field. You know, and if that's accurate, and I assume it is, that's pretty amazing. But in my world, not everyone knows what they want to do senior year. So I really had it boiled down to either an MFA in creative writing, or going on for a PhD, and at the time it was probably going to be comparative religion. So of course I wound up doing neither, and I moved to Boston, to Cambridge, because two of my good friends had moved there. One who was beginning his PhD at Harvard in Sanskrit, Indian American of Hindu, an American of Indian background who was a non-practicing Hindu, but was interested intellectually in Sanskrit and Hindu philosophy and theology. And a friend of mine who was a Jesuit priest, who's now living in Rome, and at the time he was at the Weston School of Theology studying for his licentiate degree. It's a lot of the jargon of the Catholic Church, but I looked back to double check. It's a licentiate degree, so I think he was already ordained, and I believe he's a deacon. So, you know, we would stay up till late at night talking about metaphysics, God, revelation, redemption, scripture, things that really interested us a great deal. But I also really, I moved there because I had good friends there, but I wanted to write the great American novel. So I moved to Cambridge, spent a lot of time with my friends. We had our own little interfaith circle, our little interfaith center in my apartment, or the Jesuit living room on Linnean Street, if any of you know Cambridge. And I wrote this book. And as I look back on it now, thank God it wasn't published, because, you know, it might have been the great American novel in my head, but it certainly, you know, on the printed page wasn't worth seeing the light of day. And then through a variety of circumstances, partly reading the Torah for the first time in its entirety, not out of coercion, as a reluctant Hebrew school student, but as an adult, as an intellectually curious adult, reading it much more deeply and of my own free will, as well as reading Augustine's Confessions and a few other books, and my friend Scott, the Jesuit, encouraging me to read 1 Samuel chapter 3, The Divine Call, I kind of realized that the rabbinate was something I should consider. And it was in very short order that I was back on my way to Jerusalem and beginning my first year of rabbinical school. You asked for a long bio, but it won't be that long. Writing comes into play again. I had finished the novel. I went to a writer symposium in Sitka, Alaska, spent a lot of time there before I had to go back to Jerusalem. And when I was in Jerusalem, I was part of an expatriate poetry group. So we were writing poetry, reading and critiquing one another's poetry. Of course, I was beginning seminary. Moved back to Los Angeles at the time, continued my poetry, published my first material, pretty much straightforward poetry, transferred to New York, where I finished my third, fourth, and fifth years of rabbinical school. And it was really during that time that I continued writing, and at about the end of rabbinical school, and then the first year or two afterwards, published my first two or three books that were primarily Judaica. One was a more academic book, it was my thesis, but the other two were in the area of religion, Judaica, and published by smaller religious houses. So as this went on, and I was telling the students I was meeting with earlier this morning, I knew that some way or another, I wanted to incorporate my passion for writing with my rabbinate, or as I say sometimes, my call of faith with the call of the wild. And I actually write about, you know, some of the travel experiences, travel adventures I've had. Anyone who's published here, and I'm sure a lot of you have published, knows that that is kind of a wilderness, you know, in and of itself, the publishing game. But I knew that was important to me. And so my first few positions after rabbinical school were designed specifically to allow me to have time, excuse me, I'm hoarse, write. So I worked as an assistant rabbi at a large synagogue in Westchester. I worked at a kind of Jewish think tank in Manhattan. And then I worked as a program officer at a foundation, also in Manhattan. And I was able during those few years to write a couple of more books, publish some op-eds, some personal essays, and really begin to cultivate that career, that part of my career. Of course, living in Manhattan with a part-time job while you're writing, you know, getting the huge advances, of course, that I was getting, you know, it's not that easy at all, but it was very important to me. Then after, you know, just banging on a lot of doors and meeting a lot of people, I published in some wider circulation places, Newsweek, Los Angeles Times, Wall Street Journal, and elsewhere. And that opened up the door for me to getting some representation and trying to publish it with larger secular houses, you know, the major New York imprints, which is what I did. And then when I became the founding rabbi of the synagogue, I ultimately served for over a decade before I left New York after 20 years and moved back to the safe haven of Chicago, which is where I grew up and where my parents are still living, and which is where I am right now. During that time of serving my congregation, the New Shul, which was largely made up of families and individuals who lived in Greenwich Village, Soho, and Tribeca. Any New Yorkers here, or any people who know New York reasonably well? It was a pretty progressive community, a lot of people in the arts, writers, academics, you know, psychologists, Tony Award-winning producers, Pulitzer Prize, just fascinating community of people to serve. A decade was enough, but fascinating group of people to serve. And they were very supportive of their rabbi being a writer, and being a writer in a pretty serious way. So I was able to pursue that career, go on book tours, speak as a scholar in residence, do a lot of those things that I'm sure many of you do as well. And so it was great. And I published more during that time. These were now not specifically Jewish books, but general interest, spirituality books, personal growth, where I was able to draw from my own experiences, experiences of members of my congregation or people I met with, material from Christian spirituality, from psychology, philosophy, the arts, Jewish material, mysticism, from multiple faith traditions. And it's just, and we're in the middle of a new book now, and that's the kind of interdisciplinary approach to writing that you know, is so meaningful to me. So I've tried to continue it, you know, and book writing has more or less defined my writing career within my rabbinate up to now, but of course I've also done essays and op-eds, and I continue to try to do that. So with this kind of a background about, you know, who I am and the role that writing has had in my spiritual journey, you know, what I didn't mention is it wasn't, writing was not just an outlet for me when I was in seminary to explore things, you know, that helped take me out of my head and more into my heart. The paradox, or the irony rather, of seminary studies, for anyone who's gone to seminary, sometimes you're so busy studying scripture and commentary and all kinds of other things and learning the ropes of how to pastor and guide that you don't necessarily always tend to your own spiritual growth. But my writing also helped clarify my vocation. During that year, I was hanging out with Scott and Parimal, my Hindu and Jesuit friends. I was writing this novel, and it was that novel and working through, well, the protagonist was wrestling with a lot of things, and the protagonist obviously was me. So I think the process of writing that novel, which never got published, as I said, really helped me to see that the rabbinate was really calling me in a way that I don't know that I would have identified had it not been for my friends, but I think equally for the process of writing, the creative process. So I've tried to do that up to now, and if it is God's will, if you know, everything aligns and I'm here in the spring, one course I want to teach, an elective, and something I've been thinking about for many years. So this has been a great opportunity for me to flesh out a little bit more deeply this course. And some of you may have gotten an email that I think was circulated around that is tentatively called Spiritual Writing and Spiritual Writers. Is something that I think would be of interest to the folks at EMU, students, as well as maybe community members. And it goes to my own career and my own interest in spiritual writing and writers and the way that people from Augustine to contemporary writers have really helped me to define my own career and clarify my own career. So I want to mention some of them, but just to put this in a bit of a context, that, you know, I want to limit the course just to make it manageable, obviously, to the Abrahamic faith traditions. I really wanted to explore the content, style, and purpose of these various works. And I was really interested in the literary forms. You know, I almost went on for an MFA. I have a lot of friends who've gotten MFAs. You know, when you study writing, whether as an undergraduate or as a graduate, in my opinion, by and large, you look at playwriting, screenwriting, thank you, novels, nonfiction, journalism, but spiritual writing or spiritual writers as a genre, I just haven't seen it anywhere, honestly. And that's a big reason why I've always wanted to teach a course like this, because I would have signed up in a heartbeat and it just was never offered to me. And I do think there's appeal, especially in the context of a place like EMU. But in terms of the literary forms, you know, you look at the Bible, for instance, but, you know, you look at the Library of Congress, and they've produced a book of great American sermons. You know, Stephen S. Wise, an important rabbi, Martin Luther King, I don't know about George Whitefield, but Jonathan Edwards, you know, important Protestant preachers. There's a great history in this country of sermons, of beautiful, well-crafted. I mean, wouldn't we like to hear that from our pulpits, you know, every now and then? Beautiful, well-crafted literary sermons. They're poems. You know, I'm going to talk about a couple of the poets that I imagine reading, but there are great poems written by spiritually minded people or religiously oriented people. William Blake comes to mind right away. But even people who are not necessarily religious, T.S. Eliot, you know, who of course converted to Catholicism later. But many of these poets, Wallace Stevens, or playwrights, Tennessee Williams, Eugene O'Neill. You know, these people are not thought of as spiritual writers or religious writers. But if you look at their themes, you know, they're grappling with the human journey, with the challenges of what it means to be human, sin and repentance, life and death, families and forgiveness. You know, to me, that's spiritual writing. I just want to look at it in a more overt way. And that's part of why I became a rabbi. You know, literature, English, even philosophy only took me so far. I felt that it was really only in the area of religion and theology that I was really hearing my questions raised and addressed, not necessarily answered, but addressed, you know, more explicitly than in any other field. And of course, naive, you know, graduate student that I was, I thought, well, I'm going to do this for the rest of my life. Of course, when you're serving a congregation, you know, you have a lot of other responsibilities as well. So sermons and orations, you know, that's one type of genre. Poetry is another. Psalms, you know, what's a psalm? There are 150 psalms. It's not really a poem. It's not really a book. It's not really a sermon. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Well, what is that? It's a psalm. It's Psalm 23, a part of it. So psalms is another genre, and some people have written modern psalms or feminist psalms or books. You know, you can have Aquinas' Summa Theologica. You can have a huge treatise. You could have a book by Moses Maimonides in the 12th century in Spain, The Guide for the Perplexed. You know, there are some just straightforward books that are philosophical or theological or religious, just meant to teach a community something. So there are a lot of different genres of writing or confessional writing. So there are a lot of forms. So I wanted to look at that. And I was interested in a couple of important questions. You know, after examining these forms, what is the agenda? What is the goal of the author of a particular work the work itself? Is it about transmitting doctrine or dogma? And in some cases it is. You know, this is the way the church views the afterlife, or this is what Judaism has to say about charity or prayer. Sometimes it's straightforward, you know, you're trying to impart doctrine or dogma. And other times it's more an expression of the writer's inner life, the author's journey, challenges, aspirations. Very, very different. And so I want to explore those questions as we look at some of these texts. And finally, can writing itself be a spiritual or a devotional activity, just as much as walking a labyrinth or praying or meditating or fasting or performing rituals or dietary practices or pacifism, you know, whatever it happens to be? Could writing itself be a sacrament, a principle, or at least an activity that a religious person can pursue in a serious way? So those are some of the questions. And I want to break the course down into four categories: confessional, devotional, philosophical, and autobiographical. And when I mean confessional, I'm thinking about sort of the emotional outpouring of the author's soul or heart. Devotional, a work that really is reflective of the author's relationship or struggle with God. Philosophical, you know, as the category suggests, a book that conveys the person's thought about metaphysical ideas. Or autobiographical, something that is more of a narrative, such as the book you just finished or almost finished. Or is it more of a memoir? Is it autobiographical? So just an example of a few of the books that and works that I'm thinking of including, and then I'll just kind of open up the floor. In terms of confessional works, I was thinking of starting with the Bible, the Hebrew Scriptures. And so Jeremiah jumped to mind immediately. You know, you read the book of Jeremiah, and a lot of scholars have pointed to sections in the book of Jeremiah known as his confessions. And a lot of people thought that Augustine later on and others might have mirrored some of that in their own writing. But, you know, the book of Jeremiah is not exactly a memoir, but it is, it's not exactly easy to categorize. And there are emotional outbursts of anger, of fear, of antipathy. I mean, it's a pretty wild biblical book, and I would categorize it in the area of confessional, because he's really just, I mean, at points he's really expressing suicidal thoughts. You know, he says to God, "Why did I come forth from the womb? Why did my mother not kill me in childbirth?" You know, the burden of prophecy is so great for him. He doesn't want to be alive anymore. That's heavy stuff, and it's often overlooked. But so Jeremiah, I was thinking of starting with him. Another confessional book would be Kathleen Norris. She's written many great spiritual books. You know, if Jeremiah is a piece of spiritual writing, then, you know, Kathleen Norris, I think, is someone who's a spiritual writer who writes about religious issues. And I met her a while back. She's had a few New York Times bestsellers, Dakota, The Cloister Walk, and some others, so I'm not quite sure. I have some other thoughts as well. But I was thinking of, you know, going way back with Jeremiah and then looking at someone contemporary. Moving from confessional, devotional literature. In the Jewish tradition, Yehuda Halevi, Judah the Levite, Judah Halevi, who lived during the Golden Age in Spain for the Jewish population, same time more or less as Maimonides. Lots of interaction with the Islamic world and Christian world. At that time, more the Christian world. So lots of cross-cultural influences. And he wrote beautiful, beautiful poetry that you know, and there's a lot of crossover here, but that I thought was more devotional and aspirational in nature. His longing to return to Zion, his desire and it was in many ways, you know, a society in the 12th century in the Iberian Peninsula, Spain and Portugal, that was very, I wouldn't say materialistic, but was very rooted in the everyday. And he was really interested in aspiring to something much more spiritual. Another poet from the Muslim tradition, Rumi. And I know we have a Rumi expert here who knows far more about Rumi than I do, but I've read enough of Rumi that I have been so moved and find some resonance, although it's different enough, I hope, to make it interesting, that I wanted to group these two poets, one Jewish and one Muslim, together and look at how for them, in my view, there's really a devotional aspect to their writing. Maybe even a pedagogic one too, but for me, what jumps out is the devotional aspect to it, the idea of the relationship with God. In terms of philosophical works, I was thinking of, we have one semester, so how many things can I look at? But I was thinking of looking at, going back to the Bible, the book of Ecclesiastes, or in Hebrew, the book of Kohelet, vanity of vanity, all his vanities. Many scholars think he was heavily influenced by Greek philosophy or Hellenist or Stoicism. Although in the text, he identifies himself as a king of Jerusalem. And, you know, it's a very, one student in this morning's class, the playwriting and screenwriting class, said, you know, it's a really depressing book. Why would you consider that a spiritual book or spiritual writing? And I said, well, my approach to spirituality, you know, for better or worse, and the works that I'm usually attracted to are not of the warm and fuzzy, you know, variety. I generally like the dark and stormy, you know, Sturm und Drang kind of stuff, just my own thing. But, you know, to me, someone who is looking at the world and wondering why the righteous and the wicked seem to end up in the same place, or the wealthy and the poor, or, you know, just expressing a lot of doubt about things, kind of like Jesus may have said when he said before he died, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani," my God, why have you abandoned me? Doesn't seem real warm and fuzzy to me. But this morning, you know, I was saying, well, that's spirituality. Anything that is about our relationship with God or about where we are on our journeys can be spiritual, even if it's about struggle or pain or feelings of abandonment or fear. So Qohelet for me is a profoundly spiritual book, even though it's not the most inspirational of the biblical books. So that'd be in the philosophical category. And then I was thinking of also looking at Kierkegaard. While a Jew and a rabbi, you know, he's one of the spiritual luminaries who I always go to and who really has helped me in my path. Not necessarily being a good pastor. I don't think Kierkegaard's that good if you're trying to help people in need, but certainly as a spiritual thinker / theologian / philosopher, whatever he is, he's been critically important. So I was thinking of looking at Ecclesiastes and Kierkegaard. And finally, autobiographical, I wanted to look at what some people point to as really the very first memoir, the very first autobiography written. I'm sure people would argue with it, Augustine's Confessions, partly because it was so important in my own formation and decision to be a rabbi, but also because it is such a unique book written, so many centuries ago that has been so important in terms of influencing Western civilization and certainly Christianity and Christian thought. And then Thomas Merton and the Seven Story Mountain. What he talks about in terms of his journey from Columbia and getting someone pregnant and wrestling with what he wanted to do, and then ultimately becoming a writer himself and, making fruitcakes in at a monastery in Kentucky, his dad came from the publishing industry and, he had a very robust, successful career as a spiritual writer. So those are the roughly eight works I'm thinking about doing, broken down into these four categories, and why it's important to me as a rabbi and as a writer myself. So I'm sorry it was so long, but Ed gave me my mission, and I'm trying to honor it. And so why don't we take, I don't know, we have to, as long as you guys want. I know some people have to go at 7. So any questions, comments, thoughts? Yeah.
I'm just wondering if you know any Josephus, and if so, what do you think about it?
What do I think about Josephus? Well, Josephus,
he tends to get short shrift around here.
Oh, he does? I'm not sure why. Well, Josephus gets some short shrift in rabbinical school also, because we're not quite sure what to make of him. Was he a sympathizer, with the Romans? Was he a loyalist? He was certainly a spiritual, he was more of, in some ways, I think, a historian than, or a quasi-historian than a spiritual thinker, which is why I didn't, there's so many people to draw from. But Josephus certainly is a very interesting figure and a prolific writer. His observations about the revolt against the Romans in ancient Israel or I don't know about ancient, but in the ancient Near East 2000 years ago are fascinating, both from a historical point of view and also from an identity, from a religious point of view, because here you have this Jewish scholar, historian, whatever he was, who was part of the Roman power structure, going with them and recording what was happening in these, these victories over the zealots and rebels. And yet, as a lot of people have pointed out, sometimes he really depicts them in a subtle way, maybe even subversive way, as heroic, by extension as just in their revolt against Roman occupation. But I didn't include him because I really wanted to be specific about overt themes or overt lives that were focused on one of these four categories. But he's very important. Yeah, please, Amir.
I'm just curious to know about the way in which you would elaborate on how writing in itself could be kind of a spiritual exercise.
Good question. I still need to play around with it some more. But for example, in the book I'm working on now, not to avoid your question, but I would think about the arts in general. How can the arts be a spiritual discipline, or what was your word? A devotional activity, a spiritual or devotional activity. So in the 13th century, I believe, if I remember my own research, there was a genre of art in that was extremely popular, especially in Italy, that depicted the Virgin and baby Jesus. And it was a whole genre of art. There were a lot of mediocre examples of it and then some very famous ones. But it was developed, and there was a name for it, and I'm losing it right now because it's been a long day. But art historians have given it a name. It was a, excuse me? No, it's a different one. It's not the death of Jesus. It's the birth, and he's depicted as a baby. But I don't remember the name. But it was a whole genre, and it was actually developed as a spiritual practice, so that monks, when they were in their monasteries, over and above praying and meditating and doing whatever it was they did, would focus on that work of art to help induce a kind of spiritual state in them. And that's where at least, and some of them were just standalone pieces. But I think writing for the writer, not necessarily for the reader, that's a whole other question, but writing for the writer, I mean, I think, to go back to Kierkegaard just for a second, you know, his dad was a Lutheran pastor. His brother was a Lutheran pastor. He rejected that as a vocation. You know, he wrote a book called Attack on Christendom. He wasn't real popular among the Lutherans in Copenhagen, but he was still clearly very committed to Jesus and Christian thought, or thought emanating from the relationship with Jesus. So I think, and I'm not a Kierkegaard scholar, that for him, writing became his spiritual practice. It became his discipline. We have great books as a result of it, Fear and Trembling, Either Or, lots of things. But I would guess for him, his writing was his congregation. His writing was his practice. You know, what that means for the reader is another question, and that's really interesting. You know, I can't think of others right now, but I think when writing or painting or music becomes something that fulfills you in an internal way, in a spiritual way that ritual can't or that community can't, that's when I think it can become a kind of practice, in as much the same way as refraining from pork might be a practice, or you know, practicing a particular belief. I don't know if that answers your question. I mean, there are lots of other examples, but he's probably the most towering example that jumps out right away of someone who completely rejected the apparatus of organized religion, of organized Christianity, and yet was profoundly, you know, quote unquote religious. But his religion was expressed through his books. Yes, you were very patient, or I missed you at first. Sorry.
I know that you were going to focus on that writing class more than talking about the other class, but I'm curious to see or to hear the approach that you would give your presentation of Judaism on the Comparing Monotheisms class.
Well, I mean, that it's going to be a whole semester. You got to give me a little more specificity, because what aspect are you curious about? God, prayer, ritual, community. I mean, what aspect are you, scripture?
I guess I would ask, what would be your, at least some of your goals for presenting Judaism to mostly a population that is not as familiar with mm-hmm. it? What are your goals in teaching this and in giving a glimpse of what Judaism is to the students and the participants in the class?
Good question. That I can answer. on a basic level, selfishly, I just think it'd be fun to teach. I mean, I love, you know, I said my background interfaith work, and Amir and I were, you know, talking with the other instructor earlier today, and I just think it'd be really enjoyable. And if we enjoy it, you guys, others will hopefully enjoy it. But I don't really have an agenda, but because you ask me, you know, my off-the-cuff response, because it may just be an unconscious agenda, whenever I'm in an interreligious setting, or whenever I'm in a setting where I am part of a minority faith tradition, such as EMU, part of what I like to do is simply present my faith tradition in a positive light and you know, try to convey even indirectly why it is that I've committed my life to this tradition, to this heritage, and why I find it so meaningful and transformative and redemptive. Part of it, I guess, is also sometimes, you know, dispelling stereotypes, helping to clear up misconceptions, or just simply to educate. I don't know how much, you know, people who are undergraduates know about Islam or about Judaism, or even about Christianity outside of the traditions that they were raised with. But that's a great opportunity that I think this class would afford me and us. And so I think that's really important to me. I mean, one thing that I've thought about a lot, you know, in the Middle Ages, there were these disputations, you know, because this is a good Anabaptist place. You guys, I'm sure, will be on my side here. But the Catholic Church, you know, would constantly have these disputations, and they would select some Jewish leader from the community. Judah Halevi, the guy I mentioned earlier, the poet, actually was involved in one, and at least, you know, apocryphally, you know, destroyed the other side in the debates. Basically, you know, which religion is true and which religion is false. You know, so it was almost like a kangaroo court. You know, of course, if the church is going to sponsor this and you're bringing, you know, a rabbi or a thinker and you have a, you know, some scholar, I mean, it's rigged, it's fixed. So these were really just opportunities for rampant anti-Semitism. And I don't like to talk about anti-Semitism a lot in the Jewish setting because I think it's sometimes overplayed, but this was really real. So these disputations, often one of the critiques and arguments for why Judaism was needed to be discarded and everyone needed to embrace Christianity, was that because Judaism and the Hebrew Bible, or the Old Testament, as Christians call it, was all about a God of laws, not a God of love. And I've been teaching a course in the Chicago area called The Jewish Roots of Jesus. And we compare and contrast texts, verses from the gospel with verses from the Hebrew Bible. And in my view, there are as many verses about love in the Torah as there are verses that deal with legal issues, loving your neighbor, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that many of these laws and rules and regulations are designed to protect people from one another and to create a kind of social contract where people can live in peace and with justice. So, you know, I'm not saying that I would be invited to some kind of a medieval disputation at EM in Harrisonburg, but, you know, it's always good to break stereotypes that people sometimes have about faith traditions that they're not familiar with. Thank you. Yeah.
I was just curious, back to the spiritual writing course. So with all that you're covering and teaching about, what room, if any, is there for training in spiritual writing itself?
Yeah, well, I didn't get to that at the end, but, and I'm not quite sure how we will do it, maybe as a final, paper, final project, but I absolutely want to make writing part of this course and have students write probably on a weekly basis, but then have it culminate in a play, in an essay, in a piece of narrative or fiction. So I definitely would want actual writing to be done in this class over and above the works that we're going to be studying.
Thanks. This is kind of a question that addresses your question is leaving now about it being writing being a spiritual practice. And I guess I have sort of on two sides, and maybe the nature of writing and the nature of spiritual practice. I've always found writing very cognitive. I mean, it's I spend a lot of time in my brain and scheming and plotting and planning and executing. But art, I think, in its essence, sort of gives you some sense of the other, some way to relate to the other, some way to sort of relate across our human individuality to someone else's truth. And I guess that's where I would suggest, perhaps, you know, the spirituality of art lies. And I guess this is your example, like maybe in distinction to, say, not eating pork. When I don't eat pork, I'm reminded that I'm a member of a tribe, that I'm not like people around me, that in fact, you know, I don't know, that there's a mindfulness around my own sort of consumption or whatever. Mm-hmm. When I do art or receive art, sort of, I guess I'm more of a feeling that I'm trying to speak to something human, to across human difference, to encounter otherness or something like that, that has a religious dimension to me.
No, it's interesting. I'm not sure what to say. I kind of agree with you. I think, and this is where the forms come into play. I think there are certain literary forms that lend themselves more to that kind of emotional expression and the connection with others. And I agree. I mean, my books have basically all been nonfiction. And you're right. You know, you're so busy, and with academic work too, you're so busy, you know, thinking about things all the time, that sometimes it feels like you're more in your head than in your heart. But I don't know. I mean, some of these works that we're going to look at, particularly the poems and some of the biblical books, and even some of the autobiographical material, it's pretty emotional and evocative stuff. And I think it's possible to cross those lines. You know, I've always thought that the lines between inspiration and revelation were very porous. You know, and so when I hear a very inspirational piece of music or see a very inspirational work of art, you know, to me, I wonder, and I'm thinking of a guy I interviewed from my former congregation in New York, who's a very successful artist, and he's talked about what it was like to be in the zone, and how he felt that something just came over him and took over and helped him to paint the canvas. And, you know, the way he talks about that is so similar to the way mystics talk about revelation and connecting with God in some way. So I think those lines are really porous, and I don't know when you cross them and when you don't. But I hear what you're saying loud and clear about some practices that are a little more sociological, maybe in character, that may serve to separate us from others, hopefully for a good reason, and how art helps to perhaps, I mean, you know, although I don't know, I would maybe take issue with it. I'm not sure how, for me, looking at pictorial images of the Virgin Mary and Jesus crosses, you know, lines, but it can, you know, I've seen Christian art that has been extremely moving and inspirational. So I don't know where the lines become fuzzy, but I think they do. And in some of the books that we're going to be looking at, hopefully all of them, you know, they do cross from just being purely intellectual exercises, you know, which is probably representative of Ecclesiastes or Qohelet. He's very much in his head. But then you look at Jeremiah or Rumi Augustine. Augustine's a good example, because you read the Confessions and it's this kind of hybrid of theology and memoir and just sort of confessional, where he's very, very emotional. I went to Carthage burning, 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 burning. You know, that's not someone in his head, but he was obviously a good writer and he knew what he was doing. But thank you for the question or comment. Anything else? Okay. Thank you.
Niles, we kept you really busy today. Yeah. And thank you for delivering. We're glad to hear from you and learn to know you better. And thank you all for coming out. And we'll see what develops.